You are listening to The Green Flame, the DGR broadcast that brings you radical analysis, practical skills, and artistic expression from the grassroots to the global. We are your hosts, Max Wilbert
and Jennifer Murnan.
This week on The Green Flame, an interview with Derek Jensen and Lear Keith on civilization, or what we sometimes call the culture of empire, what it is, how it functions, and why the analysis of it should provide a foundation for much of our work. Then we'll turn to the radical lawyer Will Falk on why the legal system cannot be counted on to save the planet.
Our Skillshare on this edition of The Green Flame is on the laws of nature. We have phenomenal music by Beth Quist, and we also have a poem by our comrade Ben.
Yeah, so we're here to talk about civilization, and we want to start with Derek and just ask if you can define civilization for us.
Well, when I was writing Endgame, that was one of the problems. If you look up civilization in the dictionary, the definitions are things like an advanced form of social organization, or basically they may as well just say the best form of organization, social organization there's ever been. They're all very self-promoting, but they aren't very precise, really. And so the definition I use is civilization is a way of life that's characterized by the growth of cities. And that's defensible both linguistically and historically. But linguistically, the word civilization comes from civitatis, which means state or city. And when you talk about the rise of civilization, you're always talking about the rise of cities. And so city I defined as people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. That would separate a city from a village or a camp.
The basis of civilization is this one activity, and it's agriculture. And I think in this culture, we don't have a really great understanding of what that is, where it comes from, why we do it, and what it entails. It's sort of like the fish that doesn't know water because it's really all you've ever known. We've been doing this so long that nobody really questions it. It's just sort of this thing that humans do, and isn't it wonderful somehow? So we had really just to get back down to sort of brass tacks, like what is agriculture? Well, you take a piece of land and you clear every living thing off it, and I mean down to the bacteria, and then you plant it to human use. So all of those plants, animals, mycorrhizae, like every creature, you know, great and small, all of them now don't have a home because you've pushed them all off. You've literally stripped the land down to bare soil. So it's mass extinction, and that's the first problem. And you're only growing humans on that land, and maybe a few other tiny number of species that can survive, you know, along with the crops. So some mice, perhaps, but that's about it. So all of those animals have nowhere to go. All those plants, they've all been extirpated and driven into extinction, ultimately. So every day, 200 species are going extinct on this planet. 200 species every day. And it's mostly due to ultimately, you know, this process called agriculture, because humans are simply taking the land and only using it for humans.
The guy who started me in environmentalism 30 years ago, I remember I was sitting down at a restaurant and him taking out a napkin and drawing concentric circles. And he said, here's a city and here's the area around the city that the city needs to, the city denudes to make the things that are used in the city. Where does the city get its wood? Where does it get its brick? Where does it get its copper? And where do the waste products go? And they all get taken in from outside, and then the waste gets thrown back out. And that's how cities have been from the beginning around the world. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about civilizations developing in India, China, Central America, Southern Illinois, then the Middle East, the cradle of civilization. Any of those places, what you see is denuded landscapes, devastated ecology, and cultures based on military expansionism. So I would define civilization as a way of life characterized by the growth of cities, requiring the destruction of land bases, and requiring a militarized structure in order to gain access to the resources it needs to continue.
It seems like what you're saying is this is structurally built into this way of life. Once you start living in these cities and you grow beyond a certain density that you can't sustain yourself, you have no choice but to essentially become both a imperialist in the human sense against other cultures and in the ecological sense against non-humans.
the Talua Indians, for example, on whose land I now live, they weren't civilized. They didn't live in cities. There were quite a number of Talua living here, probably about half the current population, honestly. They ate salmon and shellfish and elk and salmon and salmon and salmon and salmon and salmon and lamprey and then more salmon. And they did this. They lived here for at least 12,500 years. So, you know, under any sort of reasonable definition, they were living here reasonably sustainably. And they did not require the importation of resources. And now two things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One is that your way of living can never be sustainable, because if you require the importation of resources, it means you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource and you have to expand to get it elsewhere. And the second thing it means is your way of life must be based on violence, because if you require the importation of resources, with require being the key word, trade will never be sufficiently reliable, because what happens if the people in the next watershed over don't want to trade you for that resource? And what that means is you'll have to take it. So this is a pattern that we see many places around the world, where you have cities develop, and, I mean, if you think about it for just a few seconds, a city cannot be sustainable.
Right. So all of that, you know, the biotic lushness that should be here is gone. I mean, just for one example, in a prairie, in a healthy grassland, one square meter should have at least 25 different kinds of plants, right? But that's how lush the world should be. And it's not anymore. Now all we have is miles and miles of corn or wheat or soy. So the whole planet, you know, everything that could have been turned into this kind of monocrop has been at this point. We've reached the end of this. There are no more continents for civilization to take. So one problem is mass extinction. Another problem is that every time you do this activity, you're destroying the soil. And soil is the basis of life, or at least land life. Okay, it's what we're all dependent on. And this is what is being destroyed every time. Every time you put a plow to soil, you degrade that soil. Soil is just like us. It dies when it's exposed, you know, to rain, to wind, to sun, to, you know, temperatures. And what is supposed to protect the soil is the plants, and in particular, it's the perennials. So if you think of a tree, right, it takes a lot longer than 1 year to grow a tree. And in the time that it takes to grow that tree, the tree has put down this massive root system underneath to keep itself up and to keep itself fed and to communicate with all the other life forms that it needs to communicate with. But those roots themselves provide channels, and that's what rain uses to enter the soil. So without the physical way that rain actually enters the soil is through those channels. And you've all seen, you can picture a bare empty field, you know, when it's raining. You know, there's maybe a few dead corn stalks here and there, but the rain will just pool on the surface of that soil. Very different than when you see rain falling on a forest or, you know, on a meadow area where there is no pool of water, right, because it's being absorbed, so it doesn't run off. And every time that water does that, it compacts the soil and it runs. If there's even a tiny bit of slope, it runs off. It's taking, you know, bits of the soil with it. It's just destroying as it goes, and then the sun bakes it some more. And all the life forms that are literally making more soil are gone. So all the, you know, down to the bacteria that really do that basic work of life, it's all being destroyed. So bit by bit, year by year, there's less and less soil every time this is done. And just to put a number on that, in one season of planting your basic row crop, you know, your basic annual crop like corn or wheat, you can destroy 2,000 years worth of topsoil. So this is what agriculture does. It's just mass destruction. And so every year that goes by for an agricultural society, there's less and less soil, which means there's less food and there's less nutrition. And this is ultimately why every last civilization will end in collapse, is because it's drawdown. You're using up something which technically, yes, could be replaced, but at the rate that they're using it up, it can't be done. That's what agriculture is that using up of soil and species and water and everything. There have been 34 civilizations. Every last one of them has ended in what I've just described. And it's inevitable. This is the thing people have to understand. If you are removing, you know, the biotic community around you, if you are removing, whether it's a wetland, whether it's a forest, whether it's a prairie, whatever, anything, you remove that biotic community, it will now be simply degraded. Soil cannot exist without all those plants, and without the cohort of ruminants that keep it healthy. That is the cycle of life. Like, literally, that's what it is. And humans have removed it. On every continent, it could be removed and done this other thing instead. So what it gives you is, for a brief period, you have an advantage because the population explodes. What this has meant is people can specialize in the work that they do. So you've got, at the very base of society, a whole bunch of people enslaved to do the backbreaking labor that is agriculture. And then on top of that, there is this sort of hierarchy of other people with other skills. And one of the biggest groups on top of that is always the military. So you have people who specialize in war. They develop better weapons, and I mean, we could put better in quotes, but better ways to kill other people, to enslave other people, and they are able to conquer their neighbors. And that conquering, again, is inevitable because they themselves have destroyed their land. So by doing agriculture, they've used up their trees, their water, their soil, their fish. Whatever they had, it's gone, and now they have to go out and conquer the neighbors, drive them into slavery, take their land, their trees, their water, and the people who are best at that are, of course, people who do it full time.
One of the problems with all of this for the planet is that once you destroy your land base and turn it into military, into means, into weapons of war, and weapons of war including armies, then the problem is that gives you a competitive advantage over your neighbors who did not turn their, who did not cut down all their trees to turn them into warships. And so this is something we've seen all over the planet, which is that although individual indigenous people may be on a person-for-person basis better fighters, it doesn't matter when you're running up against, when you're using stone axes against people who are using machine guns. You can have any number of Zulus be as brave as they want, and when they're going up with hand swords against people with repeating rifles, it's a really tough battle, you know, sort of literally in this case, to try to resist. So having these global communications, etc., gives whoever has them a huge advantage, and that's something we've seen across the globe. And there's a great line by, I can't remember his name right now, he's actually a proponent. He proposes Western civilization. He's not saying it's a bad thing, but he says the West did not win the world by the strength of its ideas. It won the world through the application of organized violence. And he says that's something that people in the West often forget and people everywhere else never forget.
So this is ultimately the pattern of civilization. You have the rise of the city-state in the middle, the rise of the military class. Then they conquer everybody around them, you know, hold them enslaved, take all their goods, and then it all collapses, because it will inevitably collapse, and then it rises up again somewhere nearby. So that's ultimately the history of the last 10,000 years on this planet, and it's not pretty. By the year 1950, the world was out of topsoil. We had basically skimmed the planet alive, and there was basically nothing left, and that collapse should have happened at that point, and it didn't. And the only reason it didn't was, you know, this one sort of fluke of the modern era, we figured out how to use fossil fuel instead. People hadn't done that yet. They'd run through all the bat guano and all the other easily extractable sources of nitrogen, but the fossil fuel one was huge. So when they figured out how to turn oil and gas into usable nitrogen for plants, it was huge. So at that point, I mean, the population has quadrupled since then on the planet. And we are eating oil and gas. That's the only reason that 6 billion people are on this planet. Somewhere between there. That first billion might have been from the year 1800 to about the beginning of the Green Revolution, and then we've added since then. So all of this is only possible because of fossil fuel. And, you know, we get accused of all kinds of horrible genocidal urges for simply pointing out these inevitable facts. I'm not the person who did this. In fact, I very purposely chose not to have children. So, you know, it's not my fault. I'm just trying to explain the situation that we're in, how we got here. It's not mysterious. It's not magical. It didn't just sort of fall out of the sky. Like, there's one specific activity that has brought us to the brink, and ultimately it is agriculture. So that's where the destruction begins. And the only way out of it is actually quite simple, stop destroying. If we stop destroying, the world will come back to life. And I don't think it's too late. I think we could still sequester all that carbon if we simply let the grasses and the bison come back, for instance. They would do that work for us. But So we're always sort of up against this wall where we're trying to explain to people, like, how did things get this bad on this planet? And there actually is an answer. Like, people have understood this for 2,000 years, probably longer. I mean, you can go to, ancient Greek historians were writing, philosophers of the time were writing about exactly this, how the mountains used to be so lush, and now all the streams are destroyed, and there's no trees left, and, we've killed everything, and, anyone can observe it. You just have to look. It's not difficult to observe this. You didn't really need a microscope to see it, right? Like, the human eye is able to comprehend the destruction that is agriculture.
So many people over the years have been involved in anti-war movements, anti-imperialist movements of different sorts. And then at the same time, we have this parallel strain of ecology and the environmental movement. And so many people seem to create an arbitrary separation between these issues. You know, even at a very surface level, we can look at something like the U.S. military being the largest polluter on the planet. But it seems like when you get much deeper into this analysis, like you two are talking about, it seems like civilization and societies based on cities and agriculture, because of that overshoot that they get into, that they inherently are militarized. They inherently become these cultures of empire.
Yes, and that is precisely why all of this is related. And if you don't understand the material basis for all of this, I mean, I spent probably a decade or two of my life sort of wandering around philosophically thinking, are humans just like this? It can't be true. Because, even if you don't really study it, you sort of have the sense that for the first, 2 million years, humans weren't doing these horrible things, right? People lived in places like Africa and then Southern Europe. They weren't leaving this, like, mass destruction in their wake. Like, everything seemed to be going well for humans as a species. And then something changes, right? And then all of a sudden you have, as Maria Gimbutas puts it, she's, the archaeologist who was a big believer in, what she called Old Europe, which was a much more peaceful place. Just wonderful, wonderful archaeologist. And she said that, digging up these kinds of, the earliest patriarchal kinds of sites, it was just nothing but death, death, and more death, because all it was weapons. But if you get further into the archaeological record, there's actually really beautiful things that people produce. You can go back to the cave drawings and see, like Lascaux and these, beautiful caves in southern France and in northern Africa and stuff. And, I mean, they're stunning to look at. And it's not just death, death, and more death. It's like this incredible, this outpouring of gratitude that humans were able to do art. And what did we express? And it seems to me it's this incredible reverence and feeling of thankfulness and love, really, for all these other creatures. We can't say we weren't there, but it just seems incredible to me that, you could look at that and not feel the love and the reverence that people had for these animals. So you go back farther, and there isn't all this death and destruction. So what turned human culture into nothing but this death machine, like death of the land and death of each other and the militarism and the racism and the slavery? It's like this is not an inevitable trajectory based on human nature, but it comes from somewhere. So what is the pattern? And for me, it was just very emotionally very liberatory to say, oh, wait a minute, there is a pattern here, and it's not human nature. It's this one way of life that has created all of this. And that way of life has a name. It's called civilization. I get it. It's based on drawdown, which means ultimately it's going to have to be based on imperialism. You're going to have a military, and everything falls from there. But until somebody explains that to you, you're really just sort of lost going, well, humans are a mess. Humans are this terrible species that does these mean, evil things, and we don't know why. And maybe if we all meditate, we will stop being violent to each other. And like Derek already said in this conversation, we could all be junior bodhisattvas. It wouldn't matter if we were still doing agriculture. The military will be inevitable because we're all going to starve otherwise. And now that that's expanded to the entire globe, we all are going to starve because there's no more land to take, right? I mean, we, as a species, we've really backed ourselves into a corner at this point.
So every cell in my body wants for us to have a voluntary transformation to a sane, sustainable way of living, but it's not going to happen, which is why my loyalty is to the natural world, and I want to do whatever it takes to help the natural world.
Sometimes with this analysis, people can think that we're talking about something that happened 10,000 years ago and we're getting caught up in the past and it's all very abstract. And so I want to get back to the modern world. And I'm wondering, Let's start with Derek, maybe. If you can talk a little bit about the globalization of civilization right now and what the implications are in terms of ecological collapse.
People often ask me how I first became politicized about the environment. And it was really in second grade when somebody put in a subdivision next to where I lived, and the meadows were all replaced by white box houses, and the meadowlarks were gone, the grasshoppers, the anthills, the cottonwood trees, the garter snakes. And even in second grade, so I'm 7 years old, I recognized, if this keeps going, where will the others have to live? And I didn't have this language, of course, but I thought, you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. And so as a second grader, it affected me directly, that the places I ran and played as a child suddenly were enclosed. It was the enclosure of the commons that we have heard about so much. And so that's story one. Story two is, as I was writing Endgame back in 2003 or 4 or whenever it was, somebody from Canada wrote me to say that she had, she used to see several grizzly bears a day, but what happened was the hunters in her valley learned of the market for bear gallbladders and bear bile. And so within a couple years, all of the, she no longer saw bears. There were no bears in her, or she would see one a year as opposed to a couple a day. And what that said to me is that nothing can survive a global marketplace. Even something as esoteric as a bear gallbladder, if there's a demand for it somewhere in the world, because of the global economy, it will be destroyed.
You know, there were 60 million bison on this continent not too long ago, and the number one reason they were killed, if people don't know this fact, it's because their hides were useful in factories. They were using cowhide, and then when they discovered the bison, those they would make belts to turn the machinery, and they would last 7 or 8 times as long as the cowhide ones. And that was the reason that all those bison were killed, was literally just for the factories in New York City, you know, up and down the East Coast. And clearly it was bottomless, like they could not get enough bison to power all those machines. So they're gone.
There were more passenger pigeons in North America than all other birds combined. And they were killed for market. They were very, very cheap on the streets of Boston and New York. And this wasn't even a global market. This was just a national market. Railroads are what killed the passenger pigeon, because it allowed you to kill an entire flock, pop it onto a railroad, and have it in New York City in a day. And, you know, the great banks of cod were so large that they were impediment to shipping. There were flocks of Eskimo curlews that would darken the sky for days at a time. None of those can survive infinite demand. You know, you and I both, and anybody else who pays attention, routinely rails against the dams on the Columbia River and what they've done to salmon. But the truth is that the fish were already going before the dams. Why? Because they put in canning factories. And there were uncountable salmon. There were literally the entire rivers were full of fish with runs of salmon that would go on literally for days, where you cannot see the bottom of the river. You can't see the entire top of the river is covered with their fins. They would talk about being able to walk across the river on their backs. You hear this all the time, and it's not just the dams. Of course, dams need to come out, but also the canning factories in 1900, 1910, 1915, 1920, before the Grand Coulee went in the 30s, the salmon were already in trouble, because even someone as fecund and as with such a huge population as them cannot survive infinite demand. And one more part of this is that how it affects us today is I can't tell you how many people have said to me over the years, I grew up in such and such a place and I never go back because it breaks my heart. And I was doing a talk in Lincoln, Nebraska, which is where I was born, and my mom grew up there. And when I was there, I went to where she grew up, and she used to walk across the pasture to her grandma's house, and there is not a pasture within 10 miles. There are plenty of parking lots. There are plenty of malls. The collapse is so fast now. You know, the tiger salamanders, when I was a kid, were just incredibly common, and they're gone. Or where I live now, rough-skinned newts. When I first moved here 20 years ago, I would routinely see a couple, three a day through the summer, and now I see a couple, three per summer. And when I talk to old-timers, and this is just from the 70s, when I talk to old-timers, they said they would routinely see 100 newts at a time. I can't imagine. And so everybody, if you're paying attention at all, you're seeing it.
So I'm wondering if you two can talk about the history of anti-civilization thought. Marx was writing about what he called the slave societies back in the mid-1800s, and the critique goes back much further than that. So what can you tell us about the history of this strain of thought and analysis?
Well, I think it probably begins with the first indigenous people who were enslaved by their neighbors who had picked up agriculture. I'm sure that they were giving a very strong critique, both in words and action. And we can see then, Lear mentioned earlier, the Greek philosophers who were mentioning that the hillsides had been denuded. When we think of the Mediterranean and we think of the Mediterranean islands, that's not what they're supposed to look like. I just got a note last year from somebody who lives in Corsica who said that she was astounded to learn that they were all covered with old growth forests. And they were not rocky crags. They were lush forests. When you think of Iraq as the first thing you think of, cedar forests so thick that sunlight never touches the ground. The first written myth of Western civilization is Gilgamesh deforesting the plains and, the hills and valleys of Iraq. And so if you want to talk about anti-civ thought, really it's the demigod that the forest defender, he kills. That's really, for me, where anti-civ thought begins in the Western civilization. And we can see this. I was reading not very long ago, maybe 6 months ago, some guy in China, I don't remember his name, this is 1,500 years ago, was saying that, can we still say that the mountain is beautiful? Because the mountain used to be covered by a forest, but because it's next to a city, he said, making the connection, because it's next to a city, all the wood choppers have cut down all the trees, and now all the ground, all the soil is gone, and so can we still say that it's beautiful? One of the Roman writers talked about, I think they actually might have made up the Celtic guy to do this, but it doesn't matter because the sentiment was expressed that these Romans destroy everything they touch, and they will go to a place, they'll kill all the fish, they will kill all the forests, and then they move on to the next place. And this was written back, 1,500 years ago. And then we can move forward to Chiksika, Tecumseh's brother, saying that the whatever it touches, the dominant culture destroys, and he has this line about the whole white race is a monster and what it eats is land. And then we can move forward to Sitting Bull, saying he was supposed to give a congratulatory talk at the Golden Spike for the Northern Pacific Railroad, and they wrote a speech for him, and he didn't give it, and he gave a speech in his native tongue that said, I hate you, I hate you, I hate all white people, you've made us outcasts, you're liars, you made us outcasts in our own land. And the translator thought for a second, and then he gave the original speech in English. And I'm just saying this as a history of people who have recognized these problems, and then we can also talk. And I'm going to hand it over to Lear in a second because she's got these people better. But we've got Frederick Perkins Marsh. We've got Otto Leopold. And then I'm going to mention Hyams and Soil and Civilization and just drop it off to you.
Yeah, those are some of the main ones I would mention, too. Really, for 200 years, if you just want to even talk about English-speaking published writers, this has been a phenomenon that's noted over and over again. Like, agriculture destroys the soil, and it destroys the rivers, and it means chopping down the trees. And where is it going to end? We're really running out of continents, folks. And nobody had a great idea because it just keeps going. And then you add the green revolution, the fossil fuel into this, and the problem has just gotten exponentially worse in our lifetimes. So, yeah, here we are. And I think the other strain, perhaps, that I would also kind of throw in there would be the kind of feminist perspective on this, the sort of ecofeminism, and then the deep ecologists as well, that there are certainly people who have argued that nature has its own reasons to exist. It's not here as a resource. Every being is worthy of relationship, and the dominant culture's ideas of exploitation and that, you know, treating everything as an object is a great deal of the problem as well. But those ideas really, you have to see the material basis of how this came to be before those ideas make any sense. Because, the ideology doesn't just spring from nowhere. You know, this idea that trees are not beings, but are resources to be used, or that, you know, soil is just bare dirt to which we owe nothing. That comes from an agricultural society. It's not going to come from hunter-gatherers. It's not going to come from people who, you know, are living as members of a biotic community. It's only going to come from a culture that is imposing itself across biotic communities. That's where those ideas are going to come from. So, you know, if you can't really separate the critique of the sort of the framework of the culture without understanding that there is a material basis for why those ideas came to be. But go ahead, Derek. You good?
I want to say a couple more things. One of them is that so many indigenous people have said to me over the decades that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that generally the most open-minded Westerners still perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor. They perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings to enter into a relationship with. And how you perceive the world affects how you behave in the world. But there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman, when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. And if when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. And the same, and if you look at this particular tree and see this particular tree, you'll treat it differently still. And the same is true, and this brings us back to feminism, the same is true for, this is one reason I'm so opposed to pornography, is that it trains men to see women as orifices. And if when a man looks at a woman, he sees an orifice, he's going to treat her one way. And if when a man looks at a woman, he sees a woman, he's going to treat her differently. When he sees that particular woman, he's going to treat her differently still. And so, again, so much how we perceive the world affects how we are in it, and this culture perceives. I mean, how many articles have you seen in the newspaper about how some species is going extinct, and all they care about is how that will affect the economy? I just saw this thing a couple days ago. It's so horrible. It made me laugh out loud in disgust that I said, insects are disappearing around the world, and if insects disappear, how will we feed ourselves? It's like, no, if insects disappear around the world, the entire world collapses. I mean, this is bigger than, or it's the same with so many people. This is a problem I have with all the bright greens, and I have with so many climate change activists, is they'll say explicitly, we're trying to save civilization. They're not trying to save the natural world, and this is a problem with the entire environmental movement. The environmental movement at one point was about protecting wild places and wild beings, and it has been taken over by those who believe that environmentalism is about sustaining this destructive culture a little bit longer. And I'll say this explicitly. You know, you've got Lester Brown with his plans 1, 2, 3, 4, A, B, C, D, to save civilization. He never talks about saving the natural world. In fact, he says specifically the natural world doesn't need saving. And it doesn't matter who you talk about among these, they're all the same. And then the one other thing I wanted to say, which is a little bit of a jump, but it's another thing I think is really important to bring in, is that, you know, you were asking earlier, how does this relate to the modern days? And I can summarize all of my 25 or 26 or however many books in really one sentence, if you give me a semicolon, which is, this way of living cannot last, semicolon. When it is done, I want for there to be more life on the planet rather than less. That's all of my work right there. That's it.
Thank you. So the final question that I wanted to ask you two is about how we apply this in the work that we're doing today. And one of my interests in this podcast, you know, we've talked about whether it's easy to radicalize people who are already militants, or to, you know, take people who have this analysis already and help them understand the need to fight and turn them into militants. And so I'm really interested in reaching people who have some sort of revolutionary background, who already understand the need to fight, the need to organize, the need to struggle. And some people look at this, this analysis of civilization, and they think about it as a very abstract issue, which I think reflects the ecological disconnection that most people have. Most people aren't paying attention to the salamanders or the sow bugs or the paving of the wetlands around them and so on. So people are dealing with poverty, racism, police violence, you know, male violence, all these issues that are front and center in our society. And I'm wondering if you can respond and explain why you think this analysis of civilization is so important, and how can it actually inform and shape the work that we're doing on a daily basis today?
So Max Lear and I have got a book that's out circulating right now called Bright Green Lies, and one of the things that talks about is how, you know, solar and wind are not, in fact, saving desert tortoises or bats or birds. They're just powering the dominant culture. And I think that armed with this analysis helps one to not fall into abusive systems will lie. And Robert J. Lifton made very clear that before anybody can commit a mass atrocity, they have to have what they call a claim to virtue. And so it can be really easy to fall into those claims to virtue unless you have the larger analysis. You know, if we all wait for the great glorious revolution, then this culture is going to grind away till there's nothing left. And on the other hand, if all we do is reform work, this culture will just continue to grind away until there's nothing left. So having this larger analysis doesn't mean you don't try to stop other injustices you see along the way. My dear friend John Osborne often says, he's a doctor and also environmentalist, and he often says that the proper diagnosis is the first step toward correct treatment. And that's true. How can we solve the problems if we can't even acknowledge, here's one more way to put this, that, you know, as I've said in many of my books, that my father was extremely violent, and he could, you know, there were beatings associated with dishes not being clean enough. And so a superficial analysis, which helped save our lives as children, was that we need to clean the dishes better, or better yet, have another sibling clean them instead of you so they get in trouble. But the point is, none of those are going to solve the problem because we weren't looking at the larger issue, which is he is violent and how that was an excuse. We perforce, I'm not blaming us as children, and I'm not blaming my mom either, we perforce took those at face value. But if you have the luxury of not taking them at face value, as we have the luxury of not taking the forest industry's lies at face value, then that liberates you to be able to respond to them, not merely to their latest lie, but instead to the larger pattern.
I was wondering if having that root and defining that root, the cause of civilization, also is a potential for unification.
I would hope that that's true, and it's definitely, I think, it's an effort worth undertaking because, I mean, we all have, you know, what's the primary emergency, right? So it's the thing we feel right now is what we have to fight. And usually it's because, you know, your life or your children's lives or your community is under assault for this thing. But I think you're exactly right, Jennifer, that this overall analysis, it seems to encompass everything. Like, basically all the problems we are facing, and they are life and death issues. None of this is easy, right? But all of them do stem from this one pattern of human existence, which, you know, we name it civilization. It creates all of this in this sort of downward spiral that is now sucking the life out of the planet. But there's room for every single primary emergency sort of somewhere on there. And I feel like it does explain how we got here. And Max, to back up to your original question a few minutes ago, you know, when you talked about, so is it better to try to radicalize people who have, you know, some good analysis, or is it better to try to reach people who are already sort of militant in spirit with a better analysis? I mean, I think both are absolutely necessary, and so I'm not trying to tell other people what to do. I just know for myself, I can only talk to that second group. Like, I don't know how to activate people who just don't have it. And, like, they just don't see a problem. their personality just is not geared toward fighting. You know, they just want to get along. And those are not people I've ever understood, and I just don't know how to communicate with them. So that's better left to somebody who's been there. Because people do have those sort of conversion moments. You know, the moment I realize things were bad in the world, and then their story proceeds, and those are interesting stories, but it's not my story. So I don't know how to reach back to those people. I can talk, though, to people who already have that kind of fighting spirit, who are already activists. And I feel like what I want most, what I want my work to do, I want to get to people who they care the most about the world. They care about human justice. They care about, you know, love and compassion as our motivating force, and they see the destruction everywhere, but they don't understand the pattern. And I feel like if there's one thing I can do, it's explain that to them. Like, how did we get here? Like, where does racism come from? Where does misogyny come from? Why are we taking every last tree and every last fish? Like, it's not just human greed. It's not just human nature. We didn't do this for 2.5 million years. It's only the last 10,000, which is not that long, honestly. We can name the pattern. We can see where it starts around the world, and we can see what happens as each civilization grows and then collapses. It's the same each time, and this is why. And once it's explained to you, it's not actually that hard, right? It's just, it can take you years on your own, you know, to stumble onto the right information that does name and explain that pattern. So I feel like for me that's a great deal of where my energy goes, is just trying to explain, you know, that exact sort of, you know, set of sort of parameters of, like, so this is where we are, but this is how we got here, and this is what it's called, and this is how it operates. And I think armed with better information, people are able to then sort of, you know, retool their activism to actually, you know, try to face, you know, just the scale of the problem, because it's huge, but it does have a name and an address. I mean, we do know what it is. So I think that's, you know, the most help that I can be to this planet is to try to reach those people.
Right. Without a shared analysis, a shared understanding, it's almost impossible to build a shared strategy to address the problems.
Yeah, and I think we see this a lot right now in the environmental movement, where, you know, we've sort of touched on this already, but, you know, right now the whole thing seems to be, oh, global warming, and the only way to stop global warming is solar and wind and hydro and, you know.
Which don't even help global warming,
by the
way.
Which actually don't help, but it's like they don't have that deeper analysis. It says, actually, the problem is that we're consuming the planet, and finding a way to fuel that better is not actually going to stop the problem. And it's this kind of the same issue I have with a lot of people who are, you know, sort of against capitalism, you know, coming at it as socialists or anarchists or whatever, and it's like their problem is just how it's all distributed, and that's not actually my problem. My problem is, so you take living communities, you turn them into dead objects, and then you convert that into private wealth. And so they identify it, the problem as, well, it's when you turn it into private wealth. I mean, they think it should be distributed. And my problem is, no, it's turning the world into dead commodities. That's the actual problem. You got to back it up a step, and then you'll see, like, why this is a hierarchy, and the fact that we only have this one planet. And so, yeah, I just feel like that's the hard part, is trying to get people on who already care sort of on board with the larger, this kind of larger analysis that I think does actually explain why we are in this situation.
And along those lines of helping people to connect the dots, I think so often about a day in the 80s when I was in the Spokane Public Library and a book jumped off the shelf at me, and it was Neil Everndon's The Natural Alien. And it was the first book I ever read that did not take that perception of the world as consisting of resources as a given. And it didn't, change me as such. What it did is I remember the book jumping off the shelf at me. I opened the book, I'm looking at it, and I had this thought, oh, I'm not crazy, the culture's crazy. And it was incredibly liberating. He didn't tell me anything that I didn't already know in my heart. He articulated things that I'd not been able to articulate yet, of course. And I am forever grateful to Neil Everndon for writing that book, because I knew everything was messed up, but suddenly I saw everything whole. He showed me the pattern And, you know, I was off to work after that. It was, and that's one of the things I'm hoping for this, that we can help to do with this analysis. See, here's what I'm trying to say is that when I read Neil Everton's book, I suddenly stopped fighting myself and knew I had to fight the culture, because I no longer was thinking that I'm this lone person thinking crazy thoughts. You know, I asked Jeanette Armstrong, Okanagan Indian writer and activist, taught me so much. And anyway, in the 90s, I asked her one time, so do you ever question, since everybody keeps talking about the dominant culture like it's so great, do you ever question that maybe you're wrong? And she just laughed, and she said, yeah, I used to, but I don't anymore. And, you know, in my 30s, I was still questioning. I was like, God, maybe I'm wrong. The New York Times says it's okay to destroy the planet, and the Spokesman Review says it's okay, and Outside Magazine says it's okay, and everybody says it's okay, and that we can get along, and we can just do all this, and it won't kill the planet. And nowadays, everybody's saying that, gosh, wind and solar are going to save the day. And, you know, I don't question anymore. I went through that for a while, and I realized, no, the entire culture is rationalizing this incredibly destructive behavior.
Did you two have any final thoughts before we end in terms of what do you want people to do? What's your call to people?
Lear is the one who always says that the big distinction is not between those who believe we need to bring down the entire system and those who don't. The big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing. And I've said this elsewhere, but the smartest thing I ever did was when I was 24, 25, I recognized I wasn't paying enough for gas. I knew that the whole system is killing the planet, but the problems are so big, I can't do anything. And since they're so big, I didn't do anything. I just sat around and moped all the time. And then one day I realized, okay, I'm not paying enough for gas, by which I mean that when I buy a tank of gas, I'm not covering the social and ecological costs. So I vowed every time I fill my tank with gas, I'm going to give the same amount of money to a local environmental organization. I didn't know much, but I knew it then. You don't give to national organizations. Local environmental organization. And then, but I didn't have any money. So instead, I paid myself $5 an hour to do activism. And that's how I got started doing activism, is it was doable. If I spent 10 bucks on gas, I can do 2 hours of activism this week. And I was so scared. I didn't let any, there's a great line by Florence Nightingale, I attribute my success to the fact that I never gave nor took an excuse. And I did not give myself an excuse to not act. I was too scared to put my name on letters to the editor. Yeah, can you imagine that? And now I write books. Anyway, I was too scared for that, so I would write letters under fake names. And I would ask my friends if I could use their names, and they weren't scared, so they let me use their names. And then I did that for a little while, and then I started doing anti-circus demos. I knew circuses are terrible. I didn't know why. I didn't let my ignorance stop me. Of course, I'm a male, so that's kind of typical. But anyway, I went to the circus demo. They handed me a sign. I stood there holding a sign. Somebody came up to me, this is literally true, somebody came up to me and said, what's wrong with circuses? And I said, I don't know, ask the guy next to me. I just knew they were bad. I didn't know why. I knew they were, like, bad animals, but I didn't know the details. And then I did start doing anti-fur demos. I did anti-war demos. And then I moved from there to doing the timber sale appeals. And the point is, I got off my butt and did something. And if, you know, anybody, I don't care who you are, you can find 1 hour a week. There is 1 hour a week that you spend watching TV. I know you need to recover because you're raising a couple kids, you're working a job, maybe working two jobs, but there is 1 hour a week you can defend the planet. You can start there. Start, and it doesn't matter. Find what you love and then defend your beloved, because no matter what you love, and I'm going to turn it over because this is her line.
Whatever you love, it is under assault, and love is a verb, so we have to let that love call us to action.
Place of beauty, state of crime, this whole nation's on borrowed time. Fenced plots, but deer still roam, while humans are trapped in expensive homes. Ancient land with a new culture that won't see the circling vulture. The streets are clean, the rivers poisoned, the water's owned, the land is stolen. The birth of noise, the death of silence, kind smiles and hot violence. Warm greetings for the white factions. Brown faces get cruel actions. Land of the free, where the people are herded. The trails are clean, while the buffalo are murdered. A psycho clown is the elected king. The flowers still bloom and the birds still sing. Wilderness lives, but badly treated. Nature's hurt and not defeated. This land of beauty, this state of crime, it's killing nature, but there's still time. While the prairies grow, the thoughtful know. The losses are big, but this is war, and there's still some life worth fighting for.
Hey, my name is Will Falk, and I'm a lawyer, and I'm also a member of Deep Green Resistance. And I want to talk a little bit about why the kind of revolutionary change that we need is not going to come through the legal system. In order for me to do that, we have to have a little bit of a history lesson. And that lesson begins with the beginning of what many scholars consider the beginning of the modern environmental movement. And that is in 1962 with the publication of Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring. Now, in the going on 55 years now since Rachel Carson's book was published, every major ecosystem on the planet is doing worse than it was in 1962. What's really important for a legal analysis is to understand that in between 1962 and now, all the major environmental laws that environmentalists hold so dear have been passed. So you have laws like the National Environmental Policy Act passed in 1970. You have the Endangered Species Act passed in 1973. You have the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts passed in the late 1960s. But there, since 1970 and today, we have lost 60% of the wildlife on this planet. If you took every wild being and weighed them in 1970, they would be 60% heavier than if you weighed them all today. That to me is horrifying, and that also to me says that the environmental movement has really been getting its ass kicked. And one of the reasons it's been getting its ass kicked so badly is that most environmentalists engage in legal tactics. They believe that they can use the legal system to create the change that they need. They can use the legal system to protect wild places and wild beings. But this just isn't bearing out. And even more than that, even more than the fact that it hasn't happened yet, is the reality that it cannot happen, because American law really makes sustainability illegal. Now, there are several ways that it does this. The very first and most important way that it does this is by defining nature as property. So in the United States, nature is only considered property. Its legal status is only property. And property comes with the right to consume and destroy your property. So just like if you bought a candy bar at the convenience store, you have the right to do whatever you want with that candy bar. You can eat it, you can throw it away, you can save it, but you have the right to destroy that candy bar. Well, the same thing is true for a river. If you own water rights to a river, you also own the rights to use that water as you see fit. Now, the deep ecologist, the Canadian deep ecologist John Livingston, had a name for this. He called this resourcism. He said that whenever humans define something as a resource, that thing or that being's destruction is only a matter of time. So by the American legal system codifies, it institutionalizes the notion that nature is a resource by defining nature as property. This is not going to change. And we can do everything we can to try and file lawsuits to try and create this change, but it's just not going to happen. In order to actually convince all the judges and all the government to make this change, you would really have to go through and convince people on a very personal basis. And we don't have time to do that. So the first reason that the American legal system is not going to be a good avenue for change is that nature is only considered property. The next reason is that corporations in this country have been granted the same rights as as citizens. So when a corporation acquires property rights to part of a community to frack that community, and citizens try to stop that fracking project, the corporation can call on its own civil rights to say, to use the courts to defend its destruction. So corporations and corporate rights are another reason why the American legal system just won't create the change that we need. The third reason is what some lawyers have started to call the regulatory fallacy. So the regulatory fallacy is the idea that, or is based in the idea that people really believe that regulatory laws like the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, and the National Environmental Policy Act exist to protect what's left of the natural world, to regulate harm that's happening. But the regulatory process in this country establishes a way for corporations to gain permits for their destruction. And to really slow down what I'm saying, to gain a permit is to gain permission for destruction. So it makes harm legal. You are allowed to destroy the natural world so long as you have a permit. And these permits are, the permit application process is often written, the rules for that are often written by the very corporations that they're supposed to regulate. So to step into a courthouse and ask a court to enforce regulations against a corporation, it's just impossible because the corporations have written those regulations. And so understanding all this, understanding how unlikely it is that the American legal system is actually going to protect the natural world, the question becomes, if the legal system isn't going to work, what is? And I think in order to understand this, we have to understand that law really gains its power through violence. So you can only enforce a law if you have the force to enforce it. There's a really famous quote from the genocidal president Andrew Jackson after a famous Supreme Court Justice John Marshall invalidated one of Andrew Jackson's Indian removal laws. John Marshall and the Supreme Court made their decision, and Andrew Jackson said, "John Marshall has made his decision, let us see him enforce it." And the president controlling the military ordered the military to do what he wanted, and the Supreme Court had no power to stop it. The point is, when the courts do not have access to armed men and women, the police, to carry out their orders, they have no power. So if we're going to protect the natural world, we have to learn to use the same kind of force to protect our communities. So if we want to use a really common example, or one that's still prevalent in the American imagination, we can look at what happened at Standing Rock. So Standing Rock involved many legal challenges to what happened. Lawsuits and lawsuits and lawsuits were filed and litigated. And at the end of the day, the courts granted the corporations the power to use their right-of-way to build their pipeline. Along with that court order came the ability for corporations to call on police forces to come in and remove protesters. So, but what would have happened, or how could we have really stopped that from happening? And the answer in my mind is if we had armed local militias, our own police forces that can counteract the violence of the state. Many people in the environmental movement, I think, get lost in what they're trying to do. And they think of themselves as these very powerless beings, and they only ask, what can I do? Instead of what needs to be done. And when a lot of people ask, what can I do? They do realize, well, I can file a lawsuit. But what they also need to understand is that if in a very serious effort to arm themselves, train themselves, they could also defend their community with arms. And when the legal system has failed you and you have used every last avenue of the legal system to protect your community, I think that people have a moral imperative and a moral right to use force to defend their communities. And so I would really ask everyone listening to this who is thinking about destruction that's happening in their community, who's really concerned about some project that's destroying their home, I would ask them to start to think about whether they really need to go ask a judge whether their right to protect their home should be enforced, and instead ask themselves if they can create the conditions in their community to defend themselves from projects coming in. And at the end of the day, I think that that is where our movements have to go. We have to start to understand the power we do have, and we have to train ourselves to use force, just like those who want to destroy will use force as well.
We have heard in this episode the rules, the laws by which civilization continues its short-term existence at the expense of Earth and all her inhabitants. What are the laws by which life operates? The laws by which living beings maintain mutually beneficial relationships and create more abundance. We serve what we center. From the website permacultureprinciples.com, I quote, "The ethics of permaculture, earth care, people care, fair share are the foundation for permaculture design and are also found in most traditional societies. Ethics are culturally evolved mechanisms that regulate self-interest, giving us a better understanding of good and bad outcomes. The greater the power of humans, the more critical ethics become for long-term cultural and biological survival. Permaculture ethics are distilled from research into community ethics, learning from cultures that have existed in relative balance with their environment for much longer than more recent civilizations. This does not mean that we should ignore the great teachings of modern times, but in the transition to a sustainable future, we need to consider values and concepts outside the current social norm." End quote. From David Holmgren, these are the principles or laws by which permaculture operates. First, observe and interact. Beauty is in the mind of the beholder. By taking the time to engage with nature, we can design solutions that suit our particular situation. Second, catch and store energy. Make hay while the sun shines. By developing systems that collect resources when they are abundant, we can use them in times of need. Third, obtain a yield. You can't work on an empty stomach. Ensure that you are getting truly useful rewards as part of the working you are doing. Fourth, apply self-regulation and accept feedback. The sins of the fathers are visited on the children of the seventh generation. We need to discourage inappropriate activity to ensure that systems can continue to function well. Negative feedback is often slow to emerge. Fifth, use and value renewable resources and services. Let nature take its course. Make the best use of nature's abundance to reduce our consumptive behavior and dependence on non-renewable resources. Sixth, produce no waste. Waste not, want not, or a stitch in time saves nine. By valuing and making use of all the resources that are available to us, nothing goes to waste. Seventh, design from patterns to details. Can't see the forest for the trees. By stepping back, we can observe patterns in nature and society. These can form the backbone of our designs, with the details filled in as we go. Eighth, integrate rather than segregate. Many hands make light work. By putting the right things in the right place, relationships develop between those things and they work together to support each other. Ninth, use small and slow solutions.
slow and steady wins the race, or the bigger they are, the harder they fall. Small and slow systems are easier to maintain than big ones, making better use of local resources and produce more sustainable outcomes. 10th, use and value diversity. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Diversity reduces vulnerability to a variety of threats and takes advantage of the unique nature of the environment in which it resides. 11th, use edges and value the marginal. Don't think you are on the right track just because it's a well-beaten path. The interface between things is where the most interesting events take place. These are often the most valuable, diverse, and productive elements in the system. 12. Creatively use and respond to change. Vision is not seeing things as they are, but as they will be. We can have a positive impact on inevitable change by carefully observing and then intervening at the right time. What are the laws by which human beings lived and can live again in harmony with all creation? We serve whom we center. Civilization is enforcing a worldwide patriarchy, having destroyed or decimated traditional cultures. From the introduction to Paula Gunn Allen's The Sacred Hoop, I quote, "The physical and cultural genocide of American Indian tribes is and was mostly about patriarchal fear of gynocracy. The colonizers saw, and rightly, that as long as women held unquestioned power of such magnitude, attempts at total conquest were bound to fail. In the centuries since the first attempts at colonization in the early 1500s, the invaders have exerted every effort to remove Indian women from every position of authority, to obliterate all records pertaining to gynocratic social systems, and to ensure that no American and few American Indians would remember that gynocracy was the primary social order of Indian America prior to 1800. Among gynocratic or gynocentric tribal peoples, the welfare of the young is paramount, the complementary nature of all life forms is stressed, and the centrality of powerful women to social well-being is unquestioned. Civilization has exerted every effort to subjugate women and to erase the memory of gynocentric cultures. To throw off the shackles of civilization, we must once again become women-centered, land-based, and dedicated in working to establish and protect safe space for relationships with each other and all of life to flourish. This shift in culture can only occur if men relinquish or are forced to relinquish the privileges and rights afforded them by patriarchy. Men can end the war on women by raising sons to be good allies to women and by behaving as good allies to women themselves. Men can hasten the shift to a gynocentric culture by gifting land, giving money, and sharing knowledge with women who will and are assuming the responsibility of centering and leading and defending land-based communities. In conclusion, careful observation, as in permaculture, shows us how the laws of nature work and how we can serve nature. Our ancestors, no matter how suppressed her story has been by civilization, she still speaks to us of the laws by which human communities can exist in harmony with Mother Earth.
You have been listening to The Green Flame, a Deep Green Resistance podcast. You can find us online at dgrnewsservice.org. You can also find us on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever else you listen to your podcast. Please rate the show and leave us a review. Thank you for listening, and until next time.